Are you interested in improving your procurement and negotiation skills and understanding? Well, this is the podcast for you. The Procurement Podcast with Andy and Christoph.
Welcome again to the Procurement Podcast. I'm absolutely delighted to introduce our first call from the Northern Hemisphere in the case of Tony Crane, who I'll introduce fully in a minute. Would be totally remiss of me not to introduce my fellow co-host, Christoph. Christoph, how are you doing?
Very good. Andy, I'm doing very well, but I've picked up a very strong accent coming from you. Is this because the person we're interviewing is from the UK? Or
It is indeed, yeah. I can only apologize for that. So before he says hello, I'll give you a brief introduction to Tony. Tony's worked in the financial services industry for over 24 years, having started his career as a cashier with Nationwide in 1996. Since then, he's worked for Barclays, RBS, Santander, Bank of Ireland, and Lloyds, plus a host of smaller FS institutions and startups. Tony speaks frequently in the UK and around Europe on the topic of customer experience and the impact of societal change and what that will have on financial services industry. So welcome to the Procurement Podcast, Tony.
Yeah, hi guys.
Hi there. Great, that's fantastic. So we have a tradition on the podcast where we ask the trickiest question of all right up front. For you, Tony, what is procurement?
What is procurement? I'll just take it from, my professional standpoint of looking from a customer experience angle to say that we need to be staying strong or authentic as a brand throughout the our end-to-end processes. So we more than just a supply chain, more than just the buying of products and services. It's about presenting to our customers something that we can stand behind as an entity, and that they can get reassurance that the reasons they chose us in the first place are consistent, not just in our dealings with them, but also in all of the firms and products and services we may involve them with for our relationship.
That's fantastic. And in terms of, I mean, that sort of leads very neatly on to one of the topics that we've covered in the past, Christoph, which is around almost that the chain of authority within, whether it be in terms of modern slavery or just, you know, broader environmental issues. In terms of the businesses that you work with, Tone, what, you know, is the priority about modern slavery? Is it about the impact on the environment? Is it about best buying practice? Or is it a literally completely holistic view of all of those?
Yeah, I think ideally it would be holistic. I think in reality, this is an evolving space for firms. I think historically the procurement process has been about the budget holders making sure we're getting good bang for buck, so to speak. But increasingly, and certainly over the last 5 years, that's shifted to encompass a lot more granularity around those things you just mentioned. Yeah. It's taking longer, it's more difficult, and obviously you need to decide how far into that supply chain you want to go, which is a big decision.
Tony, you talk about modern slavery and everything, but going back to the beginning, to me, I give my money to the bank, and not only they take my money, but they also make me pay for using my money. And if I want to retrieve all the money in one go, then it's a bit of a challenge. So from a consumer perspective, and we link the consumer perspective back to the supply chain, what's in it for the consumer to be willing and in terms of service improvement that the consumer can receive from dealing through various banks? You talk about modern slavery, supply chain, all that, but from my point of view, very basic point of view. I put my money in the bank and then I retrieve whenever I need it. What sort of services are we talking about?
I think if we go back to traditionally, we take the supply chain to a slightly different place. But you know, traditionally, you would choose your bank because it had the biggest pillars outside it. It was a nice imposing building, and you felt that was a safe environment for your actual material,
yeah,
tangible money. Today, that money is digital. You haven't got it in your pocket. It's an account number and some digits. And the bank no longer has big pillars outside it, and actually the threats aren't the people that are going through, that come through the front door. They're all the different organisations that are trying to get in through the back door. And through the back door is where all your supply chains and all of your third parties are, and all of your relationships with your IT firms and IT platforms. So, you know, getting the supply chain right from a consumer perspective may not have a meaningful value at the front end, as in I can't see it, but what it does do is it gives that security at the back end. And then on the second point, in terms of what I get from the bank, I think the bank is much bigger than just, you know, holding money now. We multiple products and services. We're there for the key moments in people's lives, whether it's buying a house, getting married, getting divorced, at the end of their life, care. You know, the bank is there throughout all of those processes. It may not be the same bank, but the banking industry is present at some of the happiest times in people's lives, and also some of the most unhappy times in people's lives. So I'd like to think that as an industry, we play a pretty pivotal role in people's overall existence.
Okay. So from a consumer perspective, the bank then acts as a buffer for those immediate needs, whether it's an economic recession or it's a need or want, a house or being able to afford something that you don't have the money for, and the bank is in between. That's at the basic level is this. And from a supply chain perspective, then the bank acts to maximize or to ensure that the supply chain in the back end helps facilitate all those transactions to provide that value back to the consumer at the front end.
Yeah, and it can go a bit further. So, and again, when I was talking about the end-to-end experience for the consumer, so if we take buying a house, for example, as an example, typically a bank would only, and I use that lightly, only be involved in actually the mortgage end of that. But there's no reason why the bank couldn't be involved in the house buying element, couldn't recommend removal firms, couldn't recommend legal firms, and use its size and scale to ensure that the consumer got a better deal as a result of it, or their relationship with the bank, than they would do if they went on their own. So yeah, I think it's that piece of when I'm saying what do you want the consumer experience to be, and how far do you want your supply chain to go? They're big questions. You could just be a supplier of products, and you're absolutely right, or you can make it. And a supplier of products is more of a transaction, clearly, than it is an experience. But if you wanted to create that experience, then you need to be producing more than just a product. You need to be thinking about how can we, you know, wrap our brand around that consumer at that point in their life and make sure that it's a memorable thing, and when they get to the end of that process, they remember us as a brand as being the ones that helped them through it.
So, Tom, would it be fair to say that there's quite a bit of responsibility on the bank to be very efficient in their procurement activity in terms of how they, we touched on some of the reasons why they would be chosen from an ethical position, and you know, banking and ethics is always an interesting conversation. But that's not for us to resolve particularly today. But in terms of the practical aspects of, from what you've said, it gives a greater sense that effectively your procurement function, whether that resides in a centralized resource or in a localized team-by-team approach, is very much geared to acting in the most effective way on behalf of your client or your customer, simply because if you want this overall, you know, wonderful experience where people feel engaged, if you're purchasing or procuring on a sort of top-heavy way, in a top-heavy way, you're effectively damaging your chances of giving that luxurious experience that you're aiming for.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and I think getting the absolute crystal clarity on what it is that the institution is trying to deliver. Procurement can be a lengthy process. It can be fairly inefficient in terms of the time spent doing. From a end user perspective, fairly menial tasks like checking whether the due diligence has been completed. Again, all this stuff doesn't really benefit the end user from a product perspective. They don't see that. Making sure you are spending the time on the things that really matter, prioritizing that, obviously, because it's probably going to become a permanent fixture. I don't mean that that it's not permanent at the moment, but if you're going to create those experiences, given the dependency you'll have on external providers, your procurement team is permanently going to be in the state of either onboarding somebody, checking somebody, or deciding whether to increase the supply chain or not. And arguably there, where that procurement team sits is also a really important factor. So does it stay with the budget holders and is it purely a P&L piece, or does it move into business owners? So key strategic questions about how the structure of the organization is set up to ensure that the procurement process is as efficient as it can be.
So I think that's really fascinating. But sorry, Christoph, up to you.
Yeah, so I think I'm getting it slowly. So the bank pretty much act as a aggregator of services based on customer needs. Those customers could be a citizen, an entrepreneur, or a business. And based on the size of the customer base and based on the size of the bank can then procure those third-party services via procurement best practice in order to best benefit the end consumer.
Yeah, that's the choice for the institution. I think that's the choice that says you can simply be a provider of products, and you'll respond to consumer need at the point where they want something from you, and typically at that point you're probably going to be into a straight cost fight with your competitors you've got on the market. Or you can take a view that says it'd be really great if we didn't have to rely purely on cost and we showed value in a different way through managing the relationship better, providing things to our customers they weren't expecting from us, and then creating more of an experience-led, feelings-led relationship rather than a pure transactional cold hard cash variation.
No, that makes sense.
Yes, one of the things that really that stood out in when you were talking about that, saying the debate about where procurement resides. Does it reside purely as a function of the finance department in terms of the pure P&L of an organization, or should it reside as I think. We've discussed in previous podcasts about where should it truly reside. I think both Christoph and I gravitate to the thinking it's procurement needs to be a bit more holistic than purely the cash figure. But in the financial services space, have you got a view or a vision of where it currently sits? Does it sit with the finance function? Or does it sit in different business units within the broader organisation? Or is it a mixture of both?
Yeah, it probably is a mixture, Andy, to be honest. I mean, the procurement teams are standalone teams that certainly in the bigger organisations are cross-functional. So it'll be a centralised team that any business owner or a vertical owner can call upon. In the smaller entities, due to the scale, it'll be probably in finance where you'll find it. I think that there's a couple of questions for me around that on that point. is one is how do you measure the value of your procurement team when you're trying to assess the elements that have got the non-financial benefit. So when we're talking about environmental issues or gender equality or racial equality, how do you measure that they're doing a good job in those areas other than that they've checked that the supply chain's got the relevant signed up the relevant acts and what have you, and I think that's the piece where the customers increasingly are going to expect more than that. They're going to make sure that their brand allegiances map well against what their ethical and social beliefs are, and therefore the way in which we assess the value of procurement can't just be, oh, we're under budget this year, therefore it's a good job. And I think then it takes on a slightly different question. How do we measure the value, and how do we ensure we're driving value when we're measuring against non-commercial aspects of the relationship that we've got? Personal view is it should be a much more prominent part of the business, because I think those elements are going to become much more important over the next 5-10 years than they have been in the previous 5 and 10 years.
Christoph, do you want to answer that?
Or? Yeah, well, that it always comes back to how much that's going to potentially, in terms of added cost to the whole process, versus if being greener and being more in tune with the circular economy is going to add cost to an organization, then it has to have a very, very strong leadership to be able to justify the additional cost of being or being better in terms of the environment, in terms of social economic impact and all this. And I guess it's how much is the bank willing to add in terms of cost to ensure that, that is being driven throughout the organization.
Sorry, Christopher. I think the other interesting thing that leads on to is that, what is the cost of doing that in terms of cold hard cash, and what is the cost of not doing it? What is the cost of a business, and particularly given at the time of us recording, we've just had 3-4 weeks of significant change driven around the whole Black Lives Matter movement, and people started to make some quite fundamental decisions about whether they be political choices or practical choices, and which of those, some organizations are already being hit for CEOs of businesses who make rather foolhardy statements have seen share price being wiped off, and a number of people making decisions to pull advertising from those organizations that don't reflect the current more progressive viewpoint. And it's what's the ultimate cost of not doing all the right things, whether it be environment, modern slavery, equality, either racial or sexual. And it's a fascinating time from a procurement perspective, because it almost frees the decision making from being completely anchored to the pounds, shillings and pence, or from the dollars and the cents, to something far more affecting in terms of from a societal aspect, and that in itself might mean that the type of procurement person required to make these changes, to make the decisions about which product, which piece, which bit of material, which company to go with, it might need a more empathetic view, and some there is no doubt some CFOs will find that particularly challenging, because if they're remunerated on profitability, And that in itself most probably lends itself to the bigger question about how should organizations be truly judged? Should they be judged on purely on financial benefit, or should they be judged on a broader set of parameters?
Yeah, and I think that my view on that is that there's another angle on there as well, that if firms want to recruit talent, they probably should expect that talent to be a lot more forensic about how the firm is meeting those obligations. It does strike me as slightly hypocritical that the mechanisms that have created the problems in the first place are still going to be used to get us out of the situation. That doesn't feel like that's an appropriate response from anybody. And therefore, this what's the cost is almost, it's not an irrelevance, but I think the fact we've run it on a cost basis has created some of the inequalities that we're now being asked to face up to, and rightly so. So it probably needs a different methodology to solve the problem.
That's a difficult problem to solve, because if I'm in search of, if I need some budget to either buy a house or buy a business, and the bank says, okay, you can have the money at 2%, or you can have the money at 2.5%, but we are super green and that's going to cost you X amount of money more. So over the long term, I think I'm not sure if the end consumer is going to be willing to pay that extra half a percentage point to do the right thing. It comes back to, you know, what's, I don't know, Andy, what do you think?
I think it's a valid question to ask, and I think it's almost about how do we move the dial in such a way that you know the broader expectation is, because I would suggest if you ask my 18-year-old son, does he want to live in a world where water's in short supply and the environment is up the spout, and that crops are failing because of the situation, there's food shortages, for the sake of saving half a percent on an interest rate, I think it'll be fair to say pay the 0.5% and save the world. Whether we're already at that stage or whether it's too late is a question I'm not in any way fully qualified to answer. I can answer on an emotional basis, but it's almost about how to procurement, and it comes back to the earlier point that Tony made about how do you judge the value of a procurement function and what they're doing. How do you measure their performance against budget for non-budgetary requirements? And it's about that high element of risk that is inherent in most of the procurement decisions, but taken as a percentage weighting is very low in the overall scheme of things. If one of the aspects of a purchasing decision means that the company's at 3% risk of complete failure, that will be a significant driver for any CFO or CEO to say that 3% is a manageable risk. But if you say there is no water, then every business is completely at risk, and that's in terms of, as we've seen, the impact of the virus. If you put it in likelihood, the likelihood is incredibly small, impact incredibly high, environmental issues, you would say that the likelihood of with any inaction is really rather high. So from a purely business point of view, people would have to start making conscious decisions to support a healthier planet. I completely get your point, Christoph, in the short-term analysis. If you're confronted with two figures and you've got a higher and a lower one, and say, well, what do you want, 2 or 2.5%? Well, of course I want 2%. I'm not an idiot. But I think we might just be at that tipping point where people are more aware than they ever have been what that 0.5% brings you in terms of value. Tony, what do you think?
I think we're talking kind of, you know, will this fundamentally change in the next 6 to 12 months? Probably not, right? Yeah. So the long procurement and onboarding is a long process. And actually, we've still got a bulk of consumers that are geared up to see price as the most important thing. What I think my point is that those consumers that would buy, they're making decisions today on what they perceive to be the most important thing for them. If we all made entirely pragmatic, rational decisions, then there'd be no one buying fancy cars, for example. We'd all be buying ones that were, you know, very economical and what have you. I guess my point is, I think that there'll be a different generation now that may see that what they need to do and what their needs are has been more than just about the bottom line price. And you know, we've got to start to think about, okay, how do we evidence that we understand that group of people and that we're presenting them with an experience and proposition and a brand that makes it easy for them to feel comfortable being in a relationship with us, and doesn't make them feel that, doesn't give them that slightly conflicted position where they want to be doing one thing but they can't afford to. And that might mean that we need to get razor sharp on the procurement in the short term to create enough headroom margin wise that we don't need to put an extra percentage on because we've cut costs elsewhere. But the consequence of that is probably automation, and the consequence of automation is probably jobs. So we've got the center of all of that is what is the end-to-end experience you want to provide, and what's the cost of that end-to-end experience, the customer, and the benefit to you. And I think we're in at a stage where we're going to have to accept that some of that experience might be at our cost. And again, one of the principles we've always worked with is if we're in a relationship with anybody and one side is always going to win, it doesn't feel like it's much of a relationship. So if we're in a relationship with a customer, we can't always expect to win. And when I'm saying win, obviously from a financial perspective, there might be times where we need to be the ones who take the hit and say, do you know what, actually, in that circumstance, for that reason, we're prepared to be the ones who pay for that, because that's what being in a good relationship is all about. And it changes the dynamic of the board decision. It changes the direction of the question to say, what's the best thing to do for our customer? And if that's the same thing that we do from a financial perspective, then great. If it's not, we do what's right for the customer.
I think it comes back down to who is going to foot the bill and how much of that bill can be split between the consumer and the bank. And if we have a society that is healthy with excess cash, then yes, for sure, we are, you know, more than willing to pay an extra 0.5 percentage point to do the right thing. But if we are like we are now into a society that is struggling financially, it's a very, very hard sell. Unless, like you said, Tony, you know, we have to procure smarter to remove some of those costs out of the supply chain, which cost jobs as well, so it's kind of defeats the purpose in some ways. But you have to procure smarter and remove some of the financial stress to the end consumer by finding a way to add additional value to their needs.
Yeah, and I think the other point from my perspective is that I think possibly the days of banks being for everybody are challenged. So, you know, when we're talking about a lot of the startups and the successful fintechs, they're really clear on who their customers are and also who their customers aren't. And because they're only dealing with the people that they're geared up to deal with, they can be a lot slicker in the services that they provide, because everyone's using you know, we only want people that use mobile phones. Great, we don't need to worry about any of the other legacy stuff. So this notion that we have to have something for everybody, might not be the case. It might be that the banks need to, and all institutions need to trim and need to recognise that actually there's only 15% of the population that we're really geared up to serve in our optimal way, and that's fine. We're only going to look at that 15%, whatever 15% that might be, in whatever demographic or section of society, because we can't compete across the whole spectrum, because we've got too many small firms now who are more nimble, more efficient than we are, and can offer a completely different proposition.
And have you, through all your years in the financial and banking sector, have you seen a shift in strategy for banks to become more specialized type banks?
Yeah, I think slowly. I think, yeah, I don't know whether they would say specialized. I think this whole the shift to the creation of understand your customer personas, you know, what are your target groups, be really, really clear who the customer is that we're aiming at. I think all of that does the same thing. You know, I don't think banks are being explicit by saying we're looking to specialize in any area, but by targeting different groups then they are by default doing that. You've seen it additionally, you know, some of the bigger banks spin up greenfield or fintechs themselves to operate in different areas that maybe the main bank isn't geared up to, particularly around mobile banking and app-based transactions, etc. So I think it has happened. I think it'll carry on happening. And I think that's a natural consequence of fintech disruption and competition.
I think this is fascinating stuff. And in terms of, certainly from the procurement podcast perspective, most of the people we've spoken to in earlier episodes have been procurement people themselves. So looking at it very much from our side of the table, as opposed to the other people around the table. And one of these days we'll get a finance director on the show to tell us to tell us the number we should have come up with in the first place. But I think from your perspective, where particularly it's customer focus, it's how can we make the customer relationship one which becomes unforgettable in a positive way. It's a different slant on the role that procurement can play. Just in terms of the time that you've been in the industry, are there any examples that readily spring to mind of where the procurement function have completely got it wrong or completely got it right? That, you know, anything that sort of springs to mind in that space?
I won't probably not mentioning names, but
No names. It was this bank.
I think it comes back to probably Christoph's point that cultural change is difficult in a bank. I think cultural change in a financial department, vertical, procurement is incredibly difficult in a bank. Because they are just looking at the number. So, you know, there's been instances where you're beating my head against the wall trying to articulate the customer benefit of onboarding different types of firms and improving the indirect proposition that we have. And we're just looking at the number of that particular supplier and the cost of that supplier rather than the proposition as a whole. You know, so those banks that are very product centric, it's really challenging. And there's been many, an opportunity that slipped through the net because the institution, I suppose, hasn't been able to see laterally, the benefits of adding, value adds. Services onto the product, but equally, they the robustness of that financial number has led to the avoidance of some pretty poor decisions, because it's very easy to get emotionally wrapped up in delivering a great customer experience. That is about feelings and thoughts, and that you know, a bank giving you a warm, fuzzy feeling is an aspiration for most entities, but it is emotional when it happens, particularly when you're dealing with a situation which might cost somebody their home or they're suffering a bereavement. So, you know, at times the rigor that's been put around the procurement process has meant that we didn't go too far, and we didn't add services that were, you know, costly but relatively kind of immaterial from an end user's perspective. But I think overall the balance has been about right. I think what we don't have at the moment is probably enough people pushing for the empathetic side of things. So certainly there've been some rigorous discussions. But it's important that the procurement guys do come in from the cold hard pound note angle. I suspect we haven't got enough people in banking coming from the emotive side right now to really make sure that debate is a good one. And so consequently, we end up falling down on the side of how much is going to cost us, rather than is it the right thing to do for the customer.
And does this come back to risk mitigation, making sure that we don't get all the customers, but we are really careful as to the type of customers that we want to get, we want to be working with, whether it's a citizen or a business. And I guess very often banks struggling for revenue, they will lower the risks level in order to gain market share or to gain additional revenue coming in. But, you know, long term, when situations like what we're experiencing is happening, then a customer that has gone through, you know, a very easy risk assessment process becomes a problematic customer for both the bank and the customer himself.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and I think the conflict is probably really around the procurement guys and you know, the CFO office will predominantly be looking at this year's P&L, where the CX director is more likely to be looking at, okay, well, how do we create stuff that keeps this customer with us for the next 20 years? And so the decisions you make or you want to make in order to ensure the customer stays with you for the next 20 years might be counter to what you need to do with that customer to achieve this year's P&L. I think it is risk. And I think the risk is whether are you playing a short-term game, which is just about hitting P&L, at the risk that you're going to decline people or have people leave you that will never come back to you, and then worry about that next year when the new product comes out? Or are you going to take a long-term view that might put this year's P&L at risk, but in 2-3 years, you're going to be in a much healthier position? You know, and ultimately, that's the seesaw and the counterbalance that both sides bring to the table. I would suggest at the moment, the short-term P&L piece is probably winning more times than the long-term strategic argument, purely because of the position we're in from a financial perspective, and obviously COVID won't have helped that.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, you can't help but think that, you know, the way life has been, certainly since 2008, where, you know, the GFC and then... in the UK, there's been, you know, 10 years of austerity, and then topping that off with all very neatly with Brexit and COVID. You would imagine that despite the promise of the sunlit golden uplands of the current incumbent of number 10, the priority is going to be very securely based on what that P&L looks like. And you know, procurement has a key part to play in that. The more holistic view is something that might be pushed further to one side than perhaps we would like. But there has to be an understanding of the realities on either side. I don't think it automatically means that everything is one or the other, but certainly the balance would tip towards cold hard cash at this stage.
And just on that last point, so I think just to draw a similarity there with that mindset is it's the same thing that we do as consumers. So we're all told we should be planning for our retirement. We're all told we should save more. We're all told we should do X, Y, and Z. Very few of us actually do that because we're also entirely focused on their own P&L. So it is an inherent human behaviour, I think. And it might be generational specific. I think we're about to find out. From my perspective, I think the next generation are very different in their mindset, and therefore the world needs to look very different from a buying perspective for them. But it's difficult to critique too much the relationship between the procurement guys and the business in the short and long term piece, because it's exactly the same dilemma that we all face as individuals in our private lives.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, Tony, just out of curiosity, what is the biggest threat to a bank? What is the number one nightmare of a bank? Is it a cashless? Is it bitcoins? Is it people taking all the cash out because they don't trust the institutions anymore? Economic crisis like we are experiencing at the moment? What is the biggest nightmare of a bank?
I think it, at the moment it's like institutional failures. We've gone this far without mentioning Brexit, but we'll put it in now. After 2008, there was a lot of capital put into banks, liquidity testing on a regular basis. COVID is a completely different beast than anything we'd ever seen or projected for necessarily, and then the global nature of that. So whether it be the European Central Bank or the Fed in the States, potentially from a UK perspective, the Armageddon moment isn't on these shores. And then overlaying all of that with what might or might not happen on Brexit, the amount of uncertainty in the market at the moment is probably unprecedented. And so trying to prepare and plan for that is incredibly difficult. And most institutions will probably get it wrong if they're honest, because it's very difficult to get it right, almost impossible to get it entirely right. So I think that's the biggest issue. Certainly unemployment and the risks of that from a UK perspective would be high on the list. Touch wood, it doesn't look like it's catastrophic at the moment, but it's still early days in terms of how we work our way out of the position. And obviously a second wave would be really difficult to handle from a furloughed company perspective. So I think there's the amount of uncertainty that is non-financially related would be the biggest risk right now. I think that would dwarf anything else around Bitcoin or any threats from disruption. It is a nervous time, definitely, and it's very difficult to go and get what you were saying earlier, Christoph. Very difficult to justify spending seismic change when there's so much other change going on around us that we've not got any control over.
That's right. And you mentioned the next generation. Do you think there's going to be they're going to come up with a new innovative way? Is there another way to trade other than using banks' money? Do you think the next generation is going to say, look, let's go back to bartering as an example, where we exchange good of similar value and avoid the whole system altogether? Is this a risk to a bank, where a new ways of I guess making an organization survive is no longer reliant on an exchange of currency?
I think from a cashless society perspective, I think we'd be okay with that. I mean, there's no, we've been predominantly cashless for quite a while in real sense. And certainly from my perspective, I can't remember the last time I paid for something with cash, apart from a parking ticket. But yeah, I think that it's this groundswell. I think that it's what the next generation would want to do, and then what they're going to be able to do given the current constraints of the makeup of the system, which I know is, you know, it clearly is one of the issues that's come out of the, or the big issues that have been becoming much more evident now through the Black Lives Matter protests, in that structurally it doesn't work for that kind of bartering market, and I mean that from, you know, Bank of England down, you know, it isn't geared up. The whole of the financial services system isn't geared up to run that kind of model in an expansive way, and they're big structural barriers for that sort of change. So I think they would like to do that, and I can see that, you know, whether it be a gig economy or being far less materialistic in terms of their outlook, and far more societally focused in terms of their decision making. They've got fundamentally different beliefs. So I suppose the challenge for us is, how do we serve those beliefs and make sure that we adapt and evolve from the set systems we've got today into more flexible and fluid models? The protection, and it may not be the right answer, but protection for the industry is that for an entity to create itself and then grow to the scale, operating entirely outside of that structure is going to be really difficult, if not impossible. And that doesn't mean it's right. It just means that, you know, the banks operate and are geared to operate in a certain way, and are expected to operate in a certain way by not just the UK regulator, UK bank, but, you know, IMF, etc., etc. And therefore, in a way, that protects those institutions from major disruption from other business models. Yeah. And you know, ironically, that isn't ironic at all, actually. Sadly, that's exactly the point that's being made over the last 3 or 4 weeks.
And I think just on your point about in the nub of all of that was the requirement for the banks to be, you know, flexible and fluid and just, you know, immensely more adaptable. And they obviously have come from the old days of, you know, the high street bank of Warmington on Sea with Captain Mannering in control to where we're at now. Sorry, yeah. Christoph, you might not understand that. It was a very English reference.
That's all.
No surprise there. But yeah, I think, it, you know, the way that the old established high street banks have had to adapt, I think it's, you know, very much what we talk about here on the Procurement Podcast is about the requirement for far more flexible, fluid and adaptable procurement function, and within that the operators within the procurement space need to broaden their range of skills, broaden their experience, and broaden their, you know, their whole approach to be of true value in a, you know, an environment that is, you know, changing. And when you get completely unforeseen situations as we've been experiencing this year, not only with COVID-19, but also obviously, you know, with the fundamental change around Black Lives Matter, it is, you know, there has to be a greater adaptability within every part of every organisation. But, you know, as we're majoring on procurement here, that's a key thing.
On that point, Andy, really quickly, my utopian position would be my innovation team were also my procurement team. So my procurement team were the ones who are going out and finding new ways to be innovative with the service that was being provided already, and less reactive to requests from the business. So I think there's a, you know, innovation versus procurement, kind of discuss the pros and the cons, but I think in a utopian world, they'd be one and the same thing.
Yeah, it would go from innovation versus procurement to innovation plus procurement equals a new business model.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I think this has been a fascinating conversation. It's a slight divergence for us from the procurement podcast perspective. But I really enjoyed your insights, Tony. I appreciate your time very much. And, thank you very much for your contributions. Christoph, have you got anything you'd like to,
no, just,
to wrap up?
Yeah, this is a big emotional topic, to discuss. And so I will welcome any questions, any comments, any views, because I think this is just the surface that we are just barely scratching at the moment. But I'll be keen. I've picked up a lot of key areas and key points here through the discussion. Thank you very much, Tony. But I definitely welcome, comments, questions, and views. Feel free to email us at info@procurement.com, procurementpodcast.com. Get some feedback from the listeners.
Absolutely. And just if you could direct people to our website as well, Christoph?
Yeah, no, definitely. Website is procurementpodcast.com. Couldn't make it any easier.
Fantastic. How good is that? Well, thank you very much again, Tony. Really appreciate that. And a lot of fascinating stuff to ponder on. And as Christoph has said, if anybody listening has got any comment or insights that they'd like to share with us, then we'd very much look forward to hearing from you. That's it for me. Thank you very much, Tony. Thank you, Christoph.
Thank you, Tony.
Thanks a lot, guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Procurement Podcast with Andy and Christoph. For more information, please visit our website, procurementpodcast.com, and feel free to email us your questions at info@procurementpodcast.com.